we might.
But that's such a great book. But I feel like every time I consult her about anything, I'm like, what am I going to do with this?
Yeah, we got the blue man. Are we good?
He had gotten all this inaccurate information. Doing that,
call the House Committee on Health Care to order for Monday, March 9th. And in a minute, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3100. I do need to warn you that we will end the public hearing on or before 2 o'clock for this bill. We have lots of other work to do. And I'm going to ask all the witnesses, including me, who's going to start, to be as brief as possible to make sure everybody has a chance to talk. We have, I think, about 20 witnesses signed up or something.
Yes.
So that means, on average, most of the witnesses will take maybe 2 minutes. I'm going to open a public hearing, call Representative Greenlich, Senator Montes Anderson, and Commissioner Bainey to kick off.
Wow, this is like my first time.
You got it.
Hit the gavel quick.
I'll be bossing you around.
Should I move my chair?
No.
Okay.
You're still the vice chair.
We got to think of some chair Green, procedural questions.
Don't believe my partner in crime is quite here. Are you? Oh, you were my partner in crime as
I'm
well.
One of your
oh, good. Well, then
crime.
I want to sit by you.
I hope so. I hope the Senate is with us as well.
Okay.
That's
excellent.
Right. We're here to protect you.
Yes. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Why don't I
Please,
start?
Go right ahead.
I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlich, for the record, and I'm one of the key sponsors of House Bill 3100, which came from.
In
the 2013 session, we passed House Bill 2348 out of this committee, and that created a commission that Mr. Bainey is going to talk about and led to this bill. I just want to make a couple of points about this bill. This bill came as close as possible from the commission report, although it's impossible to go directly from a report to law. And it is a work in progress at this point, and it's going to be progressing both in this committee and in the Senate committee simultaneously. In fact, we're starting the Senate committee with a hearing on this bill as well today, or sometime during it. It creates a blueprint for the future. It talks about what every citizen of Oregon has a right to have available as a governmental public health function. And it creates the image of what public health should be. The outcome from this study will be a commission to the Oregon Health Authority to create a plan for the future for all 36 states in the county. What the bill in its current form doesn't do is make exactly clear what is intended, that every county working with OHA will have complete veto power over that plan. there'll be 36 counties, and you can't say to Curry County, here's what you're going to do, without Curry County saying, yeah, that's what we plan to do over the next 8 years if we have a set of resources. So the other thing that isn't clear here is the plan that comes out of OHA 2 years from now, which will come back to us, I hope to this committee, will say, here's what each of the 36 counties are going to be doing to move in the direction we need to be prescribing this bill and the resources necessary to take them forward. So it will be a commitment to go in this direction, assuming there are resources, and we've got lots of flexibility for each of the counties to go one way or another. So I just want to make the point very clear that we are working on this. We're taking testimony from all sorts of people. We're going to be putting it all together and working through with at least one more, maybe two more versions of this bill before we're done with it. And Commissioner Bainey did an unbelievable job as chair of this effort. She was a moderating force that led us. I have never agreed to serve on a commission that my bill started before this time. I did it because I had total confidence that Commissioner Bainey could keep me under control, which she did a great job of.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. It was a pleasure to serve with you. I, too, had not had that opportunity. Members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today. As mentioned, my name is Tammy Bainey, and I am a Deschutes County Commissioner. I also was the chair of the Task Force on the Future of Public Health Services. I'm here to provide a bit of an overview on House Bill 3100, but I'll try not to belabor some of the points that have already been brought up. Many of those that were part of this great work are in the room today, and I would say that the bill that you have in front of you is one that we may have some adjustments that we need to make, but all in all, I think the recommendations that came out of the task force are ones in which really helped to establish a framework for moving forward. The task force was convened, as mentioned, out of House Bill 2348 in 2013 in order to provide recommendations to design a public health system that essentially modernizes what we have today. The task force was truly a collaborative and open process which lasted over 9 months. We had a very aggressive schedule, and I did crack a whip. As customary in Oregon, our meetings were open to the public. However, knowing that success could only be achieved by including stakeholders and community members and partners, we purposefully created substantial opportunity for public input, often taking public comment multiple times throughout meetings. And I think that's important because we didn't know exactly where we were going, but we knew we were on the bus together. Membership of the task force included individuals from across the state. We had everyone from counties involved. We had Portland State involved. And again, many of the folks are here today. We had AFSCME involved. We had Representatives Conger and, of course, Chair Greenlick. We also had Senator Hansel and Senator Mona Anderson. So the task force recommended that foundational public health capabilities and programs be identified and funded so that appropriate levels of public health are accessible to everyone in the state of Oregon. House Bill 3100 makes that recommendation a reality. For example, the task force agreed that to keep all Oregon communities safe, we needed to assure that there were foundational public health programs such as communicable disease control, environmental public health, prevention and health promotion, and access to clinical preventative services. House Bill 3100 provides for the adoption of these foundational capabilities and programs. So no matter where you go in the state of Oregon, you should expect to have a certain level of a system in place to be able to meet the needs of community. Public health is a critical component to the public safety system in our communities. Deschutes County, for example, is 78% public land. The communities of Sisters, Lapine, and Bend have developed into the wildland-urban interface. By creating defensible space, such as clearing brush, limbing trees, and using fire-resistant building materials, we reduce our chance of a catastrophic wildfire. Why is that important? Because these types of preventative actions are no different than the role that public health foundational capabilities and programs play in protecting our communities from a disease outbreak. When we have a wildfire, we depend on a coordinated firefighting program to protect citizens of Deschutes County and proven practices to prevent and mitigate fires. We expect reliable resources and foundational programs for public safety. We should expect the same of public health in the state of Oregon. We need a robust and effective health department, just as much as you need a robust and effective sheriff's office in every community. I believe that public health is not discretionary. It is a core service that government must provide in order to protect our communities. Yet Oregon ranks 46th in the nation in per capita funding for public health at $13.37 per capita, compared to a national average of $27.40. And I think you'll find that our outcomes reflect such an investment. Unlike the system we have today, the framework the task force has presented outlines pathways for local public health to have flexibility to operationalize the foundational capabilities and programs through a single county with shared services, or a multi-county jurisdictional structure. And I think that's important. I think the task force took to heart we did not want to outline what it looked like for each community. We just knew that we needed to make sure that each community would be able to meet these foundational capabilities. The framework also offers a better alignment with coordinated care organizations in order to not duplicate services, rather to complement and align our good work together. Over the last 6 months, public health has needed to respond to new and emerging health issues that threaten the lives of our most vulnerable. Everything from Ebola, pertussis, measles, meningitis. If not managed effectively and proactively, public health threats have the potential to undermine many of the other priorities of our communities, including education and economic development. With the adoption of House Bill 3100, we will move forward with conceptual framework for the foundational programs and capabilities of a modernized public health system. We will still have much work to do to operationalize the framework, and I look forward to working with you to do that. So, Chair Greenlick, thank you so much for your leadership on this issue, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Anybody have any questions? Representative Kindergarten?
close. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for all your work on this. I have a public health degree, and so this is a very close passion of mine. I loved the analogy that you did of the firefighting. It's been a pleasure to work with Chair Greenlick, and then I worked with you maybe 10 years ago on the County Commission on Children, and I know that Deschutes County has really been a leader in connecting the health systems to the early learning hubs and now to the public health system. So it's great to have your insight on this. And I it's horrific to me that we're 46th in the country for per capita spending on public health. But having a really good plan about where we want to go with a lot of local input coming up, you know, rising up and saying what those plans are so that we make sure that the additional funding that we put into this, which I'm a strong advocate for, is directed in a way where we're strategic and clear. I think it's fantastic, so I'm very excited about this bill.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I can make one brief more comment.
Of course.
The other thing that I think I really want to point out that we need to work on is this bill, and the Senate bill is exactly the same bill, changes the relationship of public health between the state and the counties and the whole matter of how we do it in the future. What I think it lacks is a little clarity of what happens between now and then, because the statutes do change, and we will need to work on making sure we have stability in what we're doing until we move to the next stage. And I think that's another area that the bill is going to need some work on. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Representative Bueller, did you have a question?
Thank you, Vice Chair Nose. Mr. Bainey and Chair Greenlick, you used the word foundational several times. Can you define that a little bit more in this context and what you mean by it and why?
Yes.
And what's the significance?
Yes, my favorite Representative Bueller.
I hope Representative Wisner said that.
My representative, thank you. Chair, foundational meaning the basics that you should have within community, the ability to work policy, to be able to work, maybe that's in establishing tobacco prevention programs or working with local governments to establish policy. It's to also be able to stand up the ability to manage a disease or to actually have the preventative components to be able to get in front of disease. How do we make sure that we have the foundational pieces, the infrastructure, shall I say, maybe that might be a better word than foundational. So making sure that every community has the infrastructure to be able to deploy those needed essential capabilities, whether that's working legislative work to create good policy or that's actually implementing a program or a cross-jurisdictional program to be able to manage disease.
One of the things the report does is it differentiates between those elements of the foundational capabilities that need to be done by governmental public health and those that need to be done in collaboration with other partners, the school systems, CCOs, hospital systems, that it's very clear not all the work can be done by the government. For example, in the immunization of children, it happens in a variety of places. Sometimes it has to be a governmental public health, but lots of times it's done in some other place with collaboration with the public health. So the report, which I think is a brilliant piece of work for people who are interested in public health, really points out the relationship between those things that have to be done in partnership and those things that the government must do.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Vice Chair Noss. Maybe this is stepping forward from today, but we've got a 76-page report on this. And like our CCOs, which are fairly new, we have matrices to try and help show success or efficiency of dollars. As that's developed, would that be kind of the same concept? There's a lot of players involved here. So would there be incentives, or how do you get feedback on the program in the future as it would be developed?
Mr. Vice Chairman, that's an excellent question, and we did not get too into the outcome piece. I think we need to determine what we want to buy in the state of Oregon, and then we need to fund toward that. So there is still a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of determining what those outcomes are, and I think we need to do that in making sure that we, again, align with the CCO so we're not duplicating but mm-hmm. complementing, and making sure that we're not also that we're creating flexibility into communities being able to meet those outcomes, and whether they have a strong church community or nonprofit community that's providing certain services, or whether that's your local counties, whether that's through your hospital system, so that you as a community are creating what it is that you need to be doing. So the outcomes piece and the funding piece are two of the essential pieces that have not had enough conversation. What we wanted to do was to not look at funding. We wanted to also then determine what we know from the Institute of Medicine, what we should be funding toward and what those outcomes should be, but then determine is the will of the state of Oregon to move in a different direction and actually modernize its public health system. If so, that's the secondary piece.
Okay, thank you.
The bill calls for an expanded public health advisory group, and one of its main functions is to be providing input on the outcomes that need to happen as the modernization develops.
If I may, I have a follow-up,
sure.
Mr. Vice Chair. The framework, the foundational capabilities and programs are based off the Institute of Medicine, which I think is an important component. Those were not necessarily kind of free-willing trying to figure out what we should be moving towards. But I think it also is important to note that if a community such as ours in Deschutes, we want to invest general fund dollars to invest in more programs and maybe meet unique needs in our community, we can still do that. Those would be programs that would maybe just not be in another community. But again, if you came into my community, you would know that you would have the same foundational capabilities as anywhere else in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Bueller?
Thank you. It may just a follow-up to that line of questioning. If you had to pick out, say, three metrics to measure the health of a community, I know this is a little bit off the cuff, but what would they be? I mean, if we're going to invest more, as we should, more money in public health, what are the metrics we can judge success? Are there three that we can compare between counties, between states?
And Mr. Vice Chairman and Representative Bueller, I don't know that I would be the best to answer that. I could, from the hip, say that, of course, disease management, making sure that, the ability for prenatal to make sure that needs are met and et cetera, early on. But I might look to my colleague, Chair Greenlick, or someone else in the room to maybe answer that in a more precise manner. I don't know exactly what those three might be.
Well, and part of the problem is it's even a little more complicated than you asked, because part of the outcome you want to find is not necessarily what's the general health of the community, because that's the responsibility of CCOs, the medical care system, the hospitals, all of us working together. And that's important, and there are things like unwanted pregnancies and a variety of measures that you could have. But the really difficult question is going to be, how about the governmental role? Is the governmental role producing what it needs to produce in its own right? And the first thing you need to do is to be able to define what that role is and how you're going to implement it.
Right.
So this is a downstream question. Yeah. That's a very important one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Especially if you believe in the triple aim mumbo jumbo.
Okay, if there's no other questions, all right.
Well, I was just going to thank you, Mr. Chair, just point to the need for really strong epidemiology, because I think that in the you know, cutbacks in public health, we have very few epidemiologists in our state at the county level, and to not be able to track what are some of these trends, how do we get out ahead of it, whether it's teen pregnancy, whether it's smoking issues, whether it's communicable disease or any of those kinds of things. I mean, that's like, I think of that as part of that foundation or infrastructure that we've got to beef up. So.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. You're going to take the reins back over?
Okay.
We'll call up the next panel.
Lillian Shirley, and I'm going to split up the next panel. We'll bring up Zeke Smith and Carlos Crespo.
Chair Greenlake and members of the House Committee on Healthcare, I'm Lillian Shirley, Director of the Public Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here today to provide support for House Bill 3100, which, as we discussed earlier, establishes the foundational public health capabilities that are necessary to provide effective public health protections for everyone in Oregon. This bill establishes these capabilities and programs that are needed for the public health system to detect infectious diseases, protect people from environmental hazards, and to prevent those chronic diseases which are resulting in poor health. Modernizing the public health system in Oregon will create optimal conditions for health in every Oregon community. I want to thank Chair Greenlake for his leadership in this work, including his commitment to creating the Task Force on the Future of Public Health, which was established by legislation that he sponsored in 2013. As the task force met over 9 months, it was Chair Greenlake who first introduced and understood and called out that the work ahead of us was really modernizing the public health system. And this concept is what led to the bill before you. The work of the task force resulted in a truly collaborative product. The task force brought together local and state public health departments, elected officials, nonprofits, labor, and academia to determine what, from their perspective, needs to be in place everywhere so that the public health system works for everyone. The laws that frame Oregon's public health system today span more than 100 years, and many of these laws were adopted just one at a time in reaction to a disease outbreak and events that happened, some of them in the 1800s and some of them in the 1900s. So with transformation work going on in Oregon in conjunction with our hospital payers and CCOs, we have an opportunity today to really step back and craft all of our laws in a thoughtful way that modernizes the way public health system is structured and allows us to meet the needs of everyone, regardless of where they live or the conditions of their life in Oregon. Traditionally, public health played a role as a clinical safety net, and it provided some health care to those most in need and without insurance. We know today 95% of Oregonians are insured, and the health care delivery system is rewarded for better efficiency, better value, and better outcomes. While public health will still need to serve as a provider of last resort in some communities around our state, in this new world where most are insured, this means that the public health system can turn its attention fully to strategies and interventions that focus on making people healthier and preventing those diseases, as well as detecting them when and where they occur. We have broad agreement that our current public health system is not structured to best serve the needs of Oregonians, and that relying on unstable and categorical funding for public health is, in a large part, what we have to tackle together. Federal funds for public health continue to decline and often are inflexible on how they are spent to meet needs of people in our state. The public health system has pieced together funding for major health issues such as oral health, sexually transmitted diseases, obesity and its consequences, and hepatitis C. However, the scope and the scale of the response is limited because of the inconsistency, level of funding for these, other issues, and much of the funding is determined outside of our state. House Bill 3100 provides the framework for local health authorities and the Oregon Public Health Division to work collectively with other stakeholders to determine the best way to serve everyone. Local jurisdictions will have flexibility to operationalize the foundational capabilities and programs through a system that works for them. House Bill 3100 aims to achieve sustainable and measurable improvements in population health through a collective and accountable and transparent process between local and state partners. Over the next year, we'll work together as a system to define the roadmap to modernize Oregon's governmental public health system. First, together, we'll identify a common understanding of the components of each foundational capability and program. Then we'll assess the current capacity at both the state and the local level to identify how close we are to meeting those foundational capabilities. Next, we'll identify metrics and activities for measurable health outcomes to keep ourselves accountable to our citizens and to find ways to be transparent to those citizens. Finally, because we will do this work collectively, the work will identify and reflect the priorities and needs of communities across Oregon. I look forward to being a resource for you as you continue this important conversation today about modernization of public health and in the future. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the water.
You're welcome.
Chair Greenleek and members of the House Committee on Healthcare. My name is Carlos Crespo. I'm director of the School of Community Health at Portland State University. I'm also a member of the Oregon Health Policy Board, and I was a member of the Task Force for Public Health. I want to thank Chair Greenleek for taking the leadership on the task force and also for proposing this House Bill 3100. Today's major public health problems are obesity, substance abuse, smoking, injuries, accidents. These are not exactly medical problems, and they're very expensive to solve them in the emergency room. These are community health problems. These are public health problems. One of the major ways that we can actually save in healthcare is by keeping the people healthy. Healthy people uses less healthcare. Healthy people are good for business too. The recommendation of the task force calls for the establishment of these foundational capabilities and also for significant and sustained funding for these capabilities. If HB 3100 is adopted, this would mean that we will be able to work to identify these core public health priorities. As a member of the academia, I would volunteer my colleagues and myself to work with you in identifying these core priorities in public health. And to work with our community and our county and state and local governments. Another important recommendation from the task force is the establishment of accountability metrics that would be established by a Oregon Health Public Health Board. We have done something similar with the Oregon Policy Board in terms of identifying metrics for the CCOs. I think these are very critical and very important aspects of a public health advisory board. If we don't measure it, we don't know it. And if we don't know it, we don't do anything about it. So it's critical that we have these accountability metrics. Lastly, modernizing the Oregon public health system through House Bill 3100 will build upon the work in our state to transform the healthcare delivery system. As more and more people in Oregon are insured, public health can turn its attention to improving public health by preventing and reducing the burden of chronic disease, detecting and responding to infectious diseases, and protecting people from environmental health hazards. A public health system that meets the needs of everyone in Oregon is critical if Oregon is going to achieve our overall health goals in the coming years. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlos.
Chair Greenleek, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and good afternoon. My name is Zeke Smith, and I work at the United Way of the Columbia Willamette. I also happen to have the privilege of being the chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board. So I sit on that board along with Dr. Crespo to my left here. I am not a public health expert. I know you may hear from a few public health experts today, so I apologize if my language is not quite as up to speed as folks like Dr. Crespo and Lillian to my left here. But I did want to present to you three quick ideas from the Health Policy Board in relation to public health in this state and SB 3100. First of all, I wanted to just say thank you to Rep. Greenlich for both creating the task force in the first place and then putting this bill forward. So first, I wanted to just acknowledge that this bill really aligns well with our Health Policy Board priorities and system transformation as we see it as a whole. Public health is one of three priorities that the Health Policy Board recently set in 2015. So as we look at the year moving forward, public health is one of the three areas that we will be paying significant attention to. And I'm pleased that we'll be able to be in a position to support catching up our public health system to where it needs to be in Oregon as a whole. The Health Policy Board has spent quite a bit of time on shaping and developing and overseeing the transformation of the healthcare system. As you know, Oregon has clearly had a heavy lift over the last few years with that transformation process. We feel like we've successfully stood up the CCOs, managed to get 95% of Oregonians insurance coverage, but as we all know, healthcare is really a small part of overall health. And so we really appreciate the emphasis on public health and the notion that the public health system in Oregon really needs to be modernized. Secondly, again, appreciate the local flexibility in governance. As Dr. Crespo said, this relationship between kind of creating a state framework and the recognition that public health really happens at the local level is really important, and we feel that this bill creates the right kind of creativity around tailoring solutions to specific communities. Lastly, I wanted to just say that we feel strongly that it's important that we ensure core public health services. We appreciate that the bill, in essence, says that form follows function, and it lets us identify capabilities, functions, and programs needed for public health, and then really lets the form follow those functions across the state. We stand at the ready at the Oregon Health Policy Board to support what comes out of this process. We see public health as a critical part of our health system as a whole, and we appreciate the attention and time and energy that you've put into this. Thank you.
And you note the FAB essentially will be reporting to the Health Policy Board.
Yes.
This version.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, guys. We call the next panel and ask you all to please be very brief. We're never going to get through the number of witnesses that I've asked to apply. So if you have a real hardship in coming back another time, would you please let the assistant know, and we'll try and prioritize folks who've come from a long ways or have a real problem.
Okay. Kevin Campbell, Pat Ludke. Sorry. And one more.
Which one?
Gary Oxman.
Yes. Oh, Gary.
Gary Oxman.
Representative Greenlich, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the CEO of the Eastern Oregon Coordinated Care Organization. EOCCO covers 12 counties of Eastern Oregon: Wheeler, Grant, Gillum, Sherman, Harney, Lake, Malheur, Baker, Union, Wallowa, Umatilla, and Morrow.
It's a small area.
We have one member per square mile. We have about we have 50,000 square miles and about 50,000 members. The entire population of Eastern Oregon is 200,000 people, roughly, or four people per square mile. When we formed the CCO, our challenge was to be local enough to be relevant and big enough to be solvent. In many ways, that's the same challenge we face with the modernization of public health. We know that we cannot drive the entire healthcare transformation alone, but we are big enough to be a major player in the driving of health transformation in Eastern Oregon. The triple aim has to be as applicable to people with commercial insurance or no insurance as it is with people with Oregon Health Plan coverage. So we see public health as a very valuable niche in being a trusted ally to help us transform from traditional health care, where we spend about 3% of our money on population, to moving to like more progressive countries where they spend closer to 30% of their money on population. We need to be able to intervene early. We need to be able to truly do protective work. We need to identify root causes rather than just treating the symptoms. And we need to be able to be credible and trusted in the communities. All of those areas are areas that public health has a long-standing tradition of being invited into people's homes when they have new babies, working to coordinate care, and working with population health as a leader in the community. That needs to be maintained, and we truly appreciate the way that that's going to be done in 3100. We believe that regionalization, for lack of a better word, happens better from the bottom up than from the top down in Eastern Oregon. We believe that as public health has in 12 counties working with the CCO to assure that every child has a developmental screening by the age of 3, those counties are working together based on tasks rather than being mandated to work together. The key element that's missing, though, is a base level of funding that can assure that we have a core expectation of programs in each and every of our 36 counties. We're anxious to work with community, state, local, and federal authorities to make that happen. We see tasks and opportunities where services that public health has traditionally provided can be expanded. And most importantly, we're anxious to move forward with things like prevention of adverse childhood events, working to decrease poverty, and really changing community norms for healthier behavior. So we're full support of 3100, and we look forward to the outcomes and appreciate the work of the committee in the interim.
Thank you, Kevin. It'll be a part of my fantasy to see if you could turn that bottom up into one health district.
We may get counties to universal health care in Eastern Oregon. Who knows?
You're as close as anybody.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the House Committee on Healthcare. My name is Patrick Ludke. I'm a health officer, a physician in Lane County and Eugene. I also serve on the board of directors of our CCO, which is Trillium Community Health Plan, and I'm the medical director of our FQHC clinics. We have 5 FQHC clinics in Lane County. I'm here today as the senior public health officer for Lane County and also as the chair of the Health Officer Caucus, which is the caucus that represents the 34 public health officers in our county, in our state. I believe I was asked to be here because of what's happened in Lane County over the last several months, and you've probably heard of some of our interesting public health challenges. Currently, we have a big meningitis concern at the University of Oregon. We have an initiative ongoing to vaccinate 22,000 people. We're about halfway there. It's been a challenge. I'll speak a little bit more about that. We've also had the only measles case that was tied to the Disneyland outbreak, and a lot of challenges with the measles case, and it's probably the most communicable infectious agent on the planet, and we've had a lot of follow-up challenges with that. We've had several other ongoing outbreaks you may or may not have heard about. Big chickenpox outbreak in one of our schools with almost 100 people affected. And again, chickenpox is another one of those really communicable conditions that we used to think it was a fever and a rash in most people. Now in a country with a lot of people who are immunocompromised through HIV or through the miracle of modern medicine, people get chickenpox and die, unfortunately. So big concerns with that. We've had an ongoing outbreak with whooping cough as well. Another one just started actually yesterday in our county. So a lot of challenges, and I think that perhaps I can talk a bit of some of the talk about some of the challenges and how it is that it may play out in a new environment with a task force that will alter the way that public health is provided in our communities. I must add that Lane County is really fortunate that we have a robust public health system with strong support from our Board of Health and our county commissioners, but it's not like that in all the other counties. I'm a full-time person in my health department. The vast majority of our 34 health departments have a health officer that's 2, 3, or 4 hours a week, and that is not ideal, as you might imagine. Creates a lot of challenges. And given the drive from Chair Greenlick to limit this to 2 minutes or so, I will go off topic and maybe not look at my notes anymore and just talk briefly about a couple challenges that may show some of the health officer concerns as based on my county. In 2011, we had a first blip on our screen of an STD challenge in our county. Our gonorrhea, syphilis, and chlamydia rates started going up, and I presented that to my Board of Health and said, you know, this is kind of a concern to me, but I was a relatively new Oregonian and looked at the past and wasn't sure where it was going to go. In 2012, I looked at the numbers again and presented two times to my Board of Health that these numbers are really concerning and disconcerting, and we really need to address this in a way that we could. Doing a little more research, I learned that in 2009, we had closed our public health STD clinic because of resources issues. Basically, I think, probably two main reasons, the Wall Street meltdown after effects and a little bit of the challenges left over from, or perhaps ongoing, from the timber industry and the ONC lands and support. And I surveyed the community at the time, and we realized very quickly that people in my community didn't know where to go for STD services. They used to rely on the public health program. Well, we closed that clinic, and they didn't have an access anymore. And if they didn't have insurance back then, which was the case for many people, they really didn't know where to go. Consequently, our numbers went up and up and up, 2013 again, 2014. By the end of 2014, our gonorrhea rate had been up 400% in 3 years, which, interestingly, our population increased only 0.8% during those 3.5 years, roughly. So this is a real issue. So we had ongoing challenges in that arena, but we also had challenges in liaisoning with our clinical community. So we were finding out from my communicable disease nurses that we have providers who are not providing the appropriate medication or the appropriate dose of that medication for some of these conditions. And one may think that there are national organizations that provide these recommendations to physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs, and they do. However, medicine is complex, ever-changing, very, very difficult to keep up with, and there's a large local component to disease outbreaks. So one area may have a significant gonorrhea problem, one may have a problem with chickenpox, one may have a problem with some antibiotic-resistant bug, and another may not have any of those challenges at all. So there needs to be a strong local component, public health component, and communication with the provider community to make sure that they know what's going on and know how to treat it. We didn't have that resource. Even though I'm a full-time provider, I'm only 20 hours or 50% of my time in public health. The other part of my time is managing our 5 FQHC clinics, which is a full-time job. Basically. So we need that ongoing public health footprint on a local standpoint to really address these issues and to provide that local voice of what it is that's going on and how it is we can improve the health and health care of our communities. So I want to close with the sense that the final recommendations of the task force are very strongly supported by myself and by the Health Officer Caucus, and provided that all of those recommendations are in this bill and provided that the appropriate funding is secured to make them a reality, there's much to be gained from this bill's passage. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You're having fun, huh?
Yes, sir.
Dr. Oxman.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I'm Gary Oxman, a public health physician and recently retired from a 25-year history as local public health officer in the Portland area, first for Multnomah County and then as part of a regional collaboration that also served Clackamas and Washington counties. So what I bring to you is the voice of a practitioner and a practitioner who's very much involved in local issues, but one who also sees the value of regionalization. I want to just talk about a couple of the task force findings, and I think the way that House Bill 3100 addresses those. And for the record, I'm very supportive of the bill. First of all, the task force found that we really need to orient our public health system much more around health outcomes. And this is something that's really parallel to what's going on in our healthcare delivery change, the CCO model. And on a policy level, this really means having very clear outcomes and goals and priorities. What health problems should we be working on, and what should we be expected to achieve? And on operational level, it means having really well-defined metrics. What should we measure to tell us whether we're making any progress on a specific issue? And on all levels, outcomes is really critical to promoting accountability. As policymakers and as funders, you should expect your public health system to be able to come to you and say, here's the problem or the opportunity to improve health. Here's what we can do to address the situation and the rationale and the evidence that we think this is going to work, how we're going to measure the progress, and finally, what it's going to cost. So this is the kind of information that's really critical for necessary for thoughtful investment in public health, whether that investment is by the legislature, a local jurisdiction, a CCO, or another partner. So I believe that House Bill 3100 really will improve the outcomes orientation of our system. It sets very clear and consistent statewide expectations as to how the work is supposed to be done, what skills are supposed to be in the workforce, how the work is supposed to get done, how you follow up. And in terms of looking at outcomes, the foundational capabilities of assessment and epidemiology, policy and planning, leadership and health equity are particularly important to that. The other finding that I really wanted to address briefly was just that the task force felt that there's a real opportunity and necessity to improve the structure of public health in Oregon. And there's really a couple of issues here. Excuse me. One is that the current structure really doesn't promote a fully integrated approach on the part of the local and state public health. We've got great people working at both levels. We've got a lot of interesting work going on, and yet it's just not clicking together in an optimal fashion. So I've been around long enough that I really see that as a structural problem, not an operational problem. And House Bill 3100 really sets in motion an entirely new structure that I think will address that. The other structural issue is that we don't, as others have said, we don't get a reasonably consistent outcome across the state. There are some places where people are getting state-of-the-art services, the best on the planet from public health, and there are other areas where people are simply not getting anything more than very basic services, if that. So I think we really need to come together and look at that. And I think, again, House Bill 3100 does a lot to improve this structure. It does a couple of things specifically. It requires that there's a statewide public health assessment and a statewide public health improvement plan. It also creates an opportunity for local public health assessments and local plans to supplement the state plan. It allows for a very reasonable degree of local autonomy and creativity within this larger state framework. And it does that in a couple of ways. It has the individual plans, but it also has different ways that counties can come together. And finally, the bill creates a structure and potential incentives for counties to come together and to explore regionalization, as my colleague said here, from the bottom up. I really believe that regionalization is important, but I also believe that forced regionalization is not an effective strategy, particularly in Oregon, where we've had this very strong sense of local autonomy. So I will stop there. I want to thank you again for the opportunity to testify today. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Dr. Oxman was a very important member of that commission as well. Moving on. Representative Bueller.
Chair Greenland, thank you very much. Very impressive testimony and very insightful in many ways, and also brings up a lot of questions for me. Tell me the incentive structure for counties to work together and regionalize their delivery of public health services. What's the incentives for them to do that?
The incentives within Chair Bueller, Representative Bueller, the incentives within the bill itself.
Yeah.
I think there are two. One is that the bill explicitly allows for implementation to occur either at a single county or by multiple counties that are sharing selected services, or full regionalization, like creating a health district as they've done in North Central. So that's one approach. The other is that it gives the health authority rulemaking authority around financial incentives for funding, and I think those incentives could be used to encourage regionalization, and they should be in my personal opinion, to encourage regionalization where regionalization is effective and efficient.
Follow up, and I love your comments about metrics and adding to accountability, but I also think it's important to have timelines with regards to establishing of these metrics. So I see references to the metrics, and the Public Health Advisory Board 2.0 will develop those. Do you have a timeline in a sense of when we'll see those?
I don't think we're at a process where we have a timeline with that. I think that's one of the unresolved issues that we need to address. I think it's something that needs to happen very early on. I was a member of the metrics committee for the CCO model, and that was one of the first groups that came together, and it was really critical and drove the structure and the functioning of that. So I think it needs to happen early.
And one final question. The recent outbreaks of highly infectious diseases in Lane County, how much is that attributable to decreased immunization in your county?
while we wish all diseases were vaccine preventable, of course they're not. When I moved to Oregon 2011, Lane County was the third worst of our 36 counties for vaccination, and we were, I think, 49th in the country of states. Now we're the worst in the country for kindergarten immunization, and Lane County's gotten a little better. We're now about eighth worst out of 36 counties. We're still at risk significantly. Chickenpox was absolutely... almost 100% the outbreak was caused by people failing to immunize. The school that it was in, around 80% of the kids were not immunized. That's one of the most challenging schools that I have. The meningitis, you know, that's a tough condition. If you were speaking about that one specifically, numbers are very small, but of course it's a very potentially fatal condition. And this is not a broadly recommended vaccine, the meningitis vaccine. So... the measles, again, same issue as chickenpox. Our rates are far too low, unfortunately, and that puts us at big risk. I don't know if I answered your question. I hope I did.
Yeah, fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to call a couple of more witnesses. We are running out of time. We will have another public hearing, I can assure you, on this, so that we make sure everybody that wants to talk will have a chance to talk, and we'll be having some amendments being developed along the way as well, which will help that.
Morgan Cowling and Jay Bozovich. I'm sorry?
Bozovich.
Not bad. You were
you did
close.
Pretty well. I was pretty close.
I'm trying.
That was pretty good.
Actually, Chair Greenlick, Charlie Fountain, who is a member of the task force and a Benton County Public Health Administrator, would it be okay if I turn my time over to
sure,
Charlie?
Sure, he can join us. I'm really sorry about this. This is going to take a lot of public testimony before we're done. Hi, Charlie.
At least it's a popular bill.
Chair Greenlick and committee members, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Charlie Fountain. I'm a public health nurse, health administrator for Benton County Health Department, and a member of the task force on the future of public health. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials. First of all, CLO is supportive of the recommendations in the task force report and supportive of a bill that is amended to more closely reflect those recommendations. I'm not going to talk about communicable disease issues because Dr. Lutke did that, but I am going to turn to my experience in the local health department and CCOs. Health reform and the creation of coordinated care organizations has created the opportunity for new collaborations, not only to enhance clinical care, but to help prevent illness from striking Oregonians in the first place. And that prevention is the true strength of public health. Intercommunity Health Network, the CCO in my region, is acutely aware that tobacco is a major medical cost driver and that its members have the second highest tobacco use rate of any CCO. Intercommunity Health Network is an active partner, fiscal agent, and co-applicant for a coordinated region-wide tobacco prevention partnership across Benton, Lincoln, and Linn County Health Departments. This life-saving and cost-saving work is being paid for by the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement funds dedicated to tobacco prevention. While IHN works with medical clinicians to encourage tobacco cessation, they are aware that the vast sums spent on nicotine marketing mean that cessation is an endless and expensive treadmill and that tobacco prevention is necessary. In our region, the project combines clinical leverage of IHN CCO with the relationships that local health departments have to implement tobacco prevention programs in schools, to work with local landlords on cost-saving smoke-free rental policies, as well as other community strategies to reduce smoking initiation. The CCOs do not have the mandate to do population-wide prevention and policy work that public health departments are already experts in and which research indicates is necessary to reduce the future costs of smoking-related diseases. The foundational capabilities and programs model in the task force report really will facilitate these kind of partnerships between health departments and CCOs. CLO very much appreciates the work of the legislature to move this bill forward and to implement a truly 21st century public health system. We urge the passage of this bill with amendments that will more closely align it with the task force recommendations. There's a lot more in my written testimony. I'll just give you a couple of bullets on what we're recommending. An enhanced public health advisory board to set metrics and have oversight responsibilities of the new conceptual framework. Recognition that public health research and practice continue to innovate and improve on past evidence-based practice. Greater flexibility to form inter-county public health districts. Not abandoning current funding allocation systems until full cost of modernization is known and the money to fully implement this model is available. And moving forward deliberately with a transition timeline for the new model to prevent having two overlapping and separate public health systems operating in Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity. I urge the committee to listen as carefully to the voices of local public health experts as the task force did and to give serious consideration to the amendments CLO is proposing.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Jay Bozovich, and I am the chair of the Lane County Board of Commissioners, and as such, I sit as the chair of our public health agency. Lane County is supportive of maintaining the foundational capabilities for public health for all Oregonians, and as such, we support House Bill 3100 and the intent of the bill, but there are several issues with the bill that we have concern with. And to be brief, I'm just going to kind of almost do a bullet point thing. I did submit written testimony on OLIS.
I think we've had a chance to see that, and we will pay attention.
So the first thing I would like to make note of is the repeal of the ability to relinquish public health authority under ORS 431-375. Eliminating that ability, I think, is not looking at the reality of where our financially distressed counties are at this time, particularly the timber and rural counties. And I think that ability needs to stay there so we can work with the state to make sure there is no sudden elimination of public health services for citizens, particularly seeing there is no ability for a county to reorganize under bankruptcy laws in the state of Oregon. Second, I don't think requiring a minimum investment by counties is something that should be in the bill unless there is a guarantee of a minimum level of state funding to go along with that. Right now, Lane County puts about $2.5 million of our general fund into public health, and we're projected to have a $3.5 million deficit in our general fund next year, not including our $6 million deficit in our road fund. Third, there's provision in there for almost a competitive process for some of the funding.
And I think that's not intended to be. Yeah. I think that will be cleared up.
Hopefully that will be cleared up because it has not served us well with some of the CCO funding that's become competitive. We lost a critical mental health provider in Lane County because they did not get a grant. And I worry that I won't be able to keep the professional staff that Dr. Lugke depends on if I have to go up and down with staffing levels, whether or not I've gotten a grant or not, or I've gotten matching funds from the state or incentive from the state or not. Formulaic is actually easier for us to maintain that professional staff that will be there when we do have the outbreaks and the need for that staff. And I'll go down a couple quick bullet points that are section by section. I'd like to see section 19.4 eliminated. It mixes land use into a health bill. And I think that ought to be, if you want to have a land use goal, statewide land use goal around health, that's a different story. But don't make my environmental health department have to deal with land use. Section 20 missed marijuana along with tobacco as far as cessation. Now we have Measure 91 moving forward. If we're going to worry about people smoking tobacco, we should be worried about people smoking marijuana. Section 26. Is confusing as it seems to require two documents that do almost the same thing. We have a community health improvement plan that works as our community health assessment. This seems to almost require two different documents, and I wish there would be some clarification of that in the bill, whether or not one can serve as the other. I think we've done a good job in Lane County of providing that plan and that assessment. I just would hate to have a whole separate set of documents to meet this bill. So that concludes my testimony, and I really appreciate the time.
Morgan, you want a brief statement, too?
Sure. Thank you. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'll be very brief. Charlie Fountain outlined some of our concerns, but just
Name.
To Morgan Cowling, for the record, the executive director of the Coalition of Local Health Officials. Thank you. As Charlie said, we are supportive of the concept. We're supportive of the task force recommendations, and we look forward to working with the committee on some important amendments. Very briefly, Charlie mentioned to enhance the role of the Public Health Advisory Board as recommended by the task force, to have oversight of both the state and the local system as we transition. Right now, the language only has the monitoring of the local system, but the model and the conceptual framework is really for the whole public health system to transform. A couple of section-by-section improvements in the conceptual framework right now around prevention activities. It really requires that there are only evidence-based practices, and there was significant conversation in the task force about how we wanted to allow public health to innovate and have innovation, and we want to amend that language to allow for public health to innovate as well. In the local public health authority section, our one public health district in Oregon actually organizes under ORS 190 special districts, and we want to align what's actually happening in practice with the definitions in this bill. And then I think one of our most significant areas of potential concern where we'd like to see an amendment is in Section 30, which does give the Oregon Health Authority the ability to set funding formulas. It also gives the Oregon Health Authority the ability to require investment of local communities and local public health authorities. And I think that's a second piece of this conversation when we come back to the legislature after we do the work to assess what we need to implement the foundational capabilities and programs, come back and have the funding conversation with the legislature. And until then, we would recommend we continue and reinstate in this bill ORS 431-380, which has the process determining funding formulas, really a joint process between local health officials and the state Oregon Health Authority.
We can actually deal with part of that problem dealing with the effective date of when these things go in force rather than, so.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. For the rest of you, we are going to close this hearing now. You might hang around in case we finish our other things faster. I think not, but we might have a couple more minutes. But we will have another public hearing. And we are taking recommendations as we're getting for amendments. We're going to begin to start the process now where we'll start doing maybe one big amendment of things that everybody agrees on and then some alternatives that we can end up deciding. So we are going to move forward with our Senate colleagues, and thank you all very much for coming. I'm really sorry that we're out of time. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3100, and we have some work sessions to do.
Do you want to do those now, Mr. Chair?
We need to get
Representative Clem and Representative Hayden.
Yeah.
We lost.
Can we get...
You want to do the public hearing first?
I'd rather do the work session but I don't want to waste time.
Okay,
so
do you want to?
Why don't you try and get Clem and.
He needs.
Want me to go get him?
Who are you going for?
I was
going
to go get whom you need.
Oh, well, Representative. Okay, Hayden's here.
We just need Clem. Okay. All right, let's open up one of the work sessions. I mean, one of the hearings.
Where's our goal? This work session 302.
Yeah, I think that's a non-controversial one. Open a work session on Senate Bill 302. Madam Administrator, what do we have here?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 302, we had a very brief public hearing last Wednesday, the 4th. That was when the rest of you were on the floor listening to some very interesting dialogue on a floor debate. This modifies the definition of dental hygiene to include, but is not limited to, certain specified services. It specifies that the definition of dentistry and dental hygiene to include prescribing, dispensing, and administering prescription drugs for certain conditions and services. It has an emergency clause effective on passage. This is a technical bill. relating to an attorney general opinion that came down to the Board of Pharmacy. They're asking us to fix it through this piece of legislation. And it was 30 aye votes on the Senate floor.
You didn't know you'd been practicing legally all this time, did you?
No, I didn't know that.
I think I gave you the script.
All right. Can we have a motion, please?
Yes. Where did it go? Chair Greenlick, I move Senate Bill 302 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Dr. Hayden moves Senate Bill 302 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion?
Should we handcuff him now that we know he was practicing illegally?
Citizen's arrest, huh? That's why he needs an emergency clause.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I can, I believe that we ask the board to sanction him because it's not a criminal offense. It's something that I just learned on another bill today, so I just thought I'd pass that jewel of wisdom.
All right. Would you please call the roll?
Yes.
Representative
Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Kenny
Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlight?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Hayden, will you carry it?
Sure. Yes.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 302. Open a work session on House Bill 2307 as amended. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we had a brief work session on this bill, House Bill 2307. On Friday, we adopted the Dash 5 amendment. You'll recall this prohibits mental and social health providers from providing any service to an individual under 18 years of age for the purpose of attempting to change the individual's sexual orientation or gender identity.
Representative Nose?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House Bill 2307 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 2307 to the floor as amended with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair?
I've got a few hands.
Representative Widener?
Did we adopt the Dash 5 amendments in that?
Yes.
Okay. I thought we did. Once again, I'd like to compliment Representative Nose for the way he's worked on this bill, the way he's handled it. Actually, the people that are pushing the bill, they've done a very good job of keeping us informed in the loop. I'm proud of each and every one of them, their thoughtfulness and the way that they've handled this. I really appreciate them coming up with the Dash 5 amendments. Where I'm at right now, I've been torn and struggled on this bill because when we get into someone's profession, when you get into psychology, psychiatry, counseling, sometimes you choose a counselor because you want them to steer you a certain direction or a certain way. There's a lot of things that go on, and I, as much as I would like to be able to support it, I can't, just because I'm sitting here looking at the industry and what happens in the industry, and I don't know if it's our place to actually be delving into it, and I think it's something that they should be dealing with as a group themselves for what counseling is, because there's other things that counselors do just in marriage counseling and things like that where I've had discussions with some of the people that I don't think are appropriate, but it's something they've determined to be appropriate in their scope of work and what they do. So with that, I will be a no vote on it, just because of industrial needs and everything else and the way they react to situations. So
thank you. Representative Kinnemer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has been a difficult bill for me. I've struggled with it. First became acquainted with these kinds of attempts at therapy back in, as best I can recall, about the mid-80s. And at that time, I did it. Although that's not an area in which I practiced, I did some literature research because I was involved in making referrals from time to time for whatever reasons people might come to me. And I found the data was pretty mixed on the outcomes, and in fact, my view was that it was negative. And I was personally, I was going to say unsupportive. Actually, I think I was anti-supportive, but I just didn't think it was there. However, I guess at a couple of different levels, some things that come to me is that we have licensing boards to regulate professional practices. And I think that this is among those examples. And I think we get into a dangerous precedent in deciding when things are important enough or to elevate them to spell it out from the legislative level. And we're not experts on research. For example, in researching this, I discovered that the American Psychological Association convened a task force, and they found regarding this type of therapy that the, quote, research was inadequate and indeterminate. So we're making a decision when the data is not clear, and we're making a professional judgment, in my view. And I have some concerns about that. I think it becomes a bad precedent, although I certainly would not recommend the therapy. I think I have another question and that is at 17 and a half, it's completely inappropriate. At 18, it's okay. I think that's, if it's not okay, it's probably not okay. And then some other things. Social workers, for example, and I'm sorry, I should have pulled the psychologist, but anyhow, a couple of things, if I may read from their licensing acts. Unprofessional conduct means conduct unbecoming a licensee or detrimental to the best interest of the public, including conduct contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the licensee's profession, or conduct that endangers the health, safety, or welfare of a patient or client. In addition to that, they have another one that says that a licensee may not, quote, condone or engage in discrimination based on sexual orientation. Frankly, I think a better approach would be for the committee to send letters to all of the licensing boards that would be affected under this bill and find out specifically, and I appreciate the efforts by the administrator and myself and also for one of the lobbyists who worked on this issue to try and get clarity on this. I think we would do well to have clarity from the licensing boards, and if we're going to make a judgment, then at least it would be better informed. And I thank you for indulging me.
Thank you, Representative Kennemer. Representative Buehler?
Yeah, I just wanted to hear Representative Kennemer's findings and opinion from Friday.
Okay. Thank you. Any other discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kennemer?
No.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Whitener?
No.
Vice Chair Hayden?
No.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. 2307 on the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Nose, will you carry it?
Absolutely.
Close the work session on HB 2307. Open a work session on HB 2626.
Mr. Chairman.
Madam Minister, what do we have?
We have House Bill 2626. We had a public hearing on February 11th. This, you might recall, authorizes the state treasurer to issue lottery bonds to finance grants, and then the grants go to the Department of Education, which then distributes them to school districts to pay for acquisition, construction, or improvement of school-based health centers. It establishes an Oregon School-Based Health Center Construction Grant Fund, declares an emergency effective on passage. You have a -1 amendment. The -1 amendment fills in the allocation amount of $4 million. This has because it has a fiscal impact, it requires a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do we have a motion on it?
Chair Greenlick, I move House Bill 2626 as
have to amend it first.
Yes.
Do we?
Yes.
Oh. Chair Greenlick, I move to adopt the -1 amendment dated 2/9/15.
Representative Hayden moves we adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 2626 dated 2/9/15. Is there any discussion? Any objection?
Mr.
Chair. I'm sorry.
Yeah. On the amendment?
Yeah.
So, actually, I'm good on the amendment. The bill itself is what I wanted to discuss.
Okay. Any objection to the amendment? -1's a part of the bill. Let's get a motion, and then we'll go to Representative Widener.
Chair Greenlick, I move House Bill 2626 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Hayden moves that House Bill 2626 to the move to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have school-based health centers in my district and everything. And I've actually taken my child to them for physical and everything. So I've used them. There's a convenience with them. But one of the issues that I see with them is sometimes they're seeing students or minors and the parents aren't being notified that the child's been there or anything like that. And as a parent, it bothers me that I can't give my child aspirin to take to school or they can't have them, but they can go down and get medication or be seen at the school-based health center or the health clinic and be treated there, and I don't get any information on that. So for that reason, because I want us to look into that and have more parental notification with the health centers, I will be a no vote on it.
Is there any other discussion? Could you please call the roll?
Yes.
Representative Kenny Dyer?
Aye.
Representative Leidner?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlight?
Aye.
Motion carries, and House Bill 2626 as amended moves to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 2626. Open up a hearing on House Bill 2880. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2880. You caught me off guard.
I'm sorry. She was pointing at a different number.
That's right. Specifies that a physician assistant may not practice fluoroscopy on a person unless the physician assistant holds a certificate that has been issued by the Board of Medical Imaging, requires that the physician assistant to complete 80 hours of didactic and clinical training and pass the examination, directs the Board of Medical Imaging to issue the certificate. This has an August 1, 2016 operative date, and it does have an emergency clause, and I believe they'll be speaking to some amendments that they've had drafted, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we do call the first panel. Again, we've got two public hearings between now and 2:45, so I'll ask you all to be as brief as you can.
We have Elizabeth Remley.
I think mine, that's what should be.
Judah Gold Markell and Greg Kozla.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Remley, here today on behalf of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. OSPA is pleased to bring House Bill 2880 to you. Judah and Greg, who will talk next, have been working on this bill for several years with the Board of Medical Imaging and Radiation Protection Services. The bill would set up a certificate program at the Board of Medical Imaging that would go on file with their physician assistant license at the medical board to allow PAs to do fluoroscopy. Fluoroscopy is a type of ionizing radiation. 32 states already allow PAs to do fluoroscopy, so we would be joining the 10 states that require very stringent requirements, training, clinical training, and schooling an online course to learn how to do fluoroscopy and be able to do it, and then an exam at the end. I will let Greg and Judah describe how that works, but we do appreciate the work that the Medical Association, the Medical Board, the Board of Medical Imaging and Radiation Protection Services have put into considering how to set this up for them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm Greg Kozloff, and I'm a PA, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2880. I currently work for Radiology Associates, which is an interventional radiology practice in Eugene, and this legislation will allow me to provide efficient, effective care while still ensuring patient safety. Fluoroscopy is a live, moving X-ray that is used in a wide array of medical procedures. Among other things, we use fluoroscopy to guide the placement of needles, wires, and catheters, and to take detailed images of blood vessels and other dynamic structures.
Fluoroscopy allows us to perform these procedures much more safely and quickly than would otherwise be possible. PAs practice medicine in a variety of settings where fluoroscopy is used, including orthopedics, interventional radiology, cardiology, and vascular and endovascular surgery. While many PAs will never need to use fluoroscopy in their setting, for a limited number of us, this is proving to be more and more valuable. As technology pushes us towards more minimally invasive procedures, the use of fluoroscopy will continue to play a critical role. My inability to utilize fluoroscopy has led to delays in care for our patients. I've been trained and credentialed to place hemodialysis catheters, IV ports, and other central lines, but because I cannot use fluoroscopy, my ability to perform these procedures is limited. I often have to choose between placing a central line without the use of fluoroscopy or delaying the procedure until the radiologist becomes available. In many cases, the procedure cannot be done without fluoroscopy, and we have no choice but to delay the procedure. Fluoroscopy utilization reduces complications and delays in the placement of lines leads to delays in patient care. There are additional aspects to our practice where a PA would be valuable, but my inability to use fluoroscopy has made this impossible. Less complex cases such as gastrostomy or jejunostomy tube exchanges could easily and safely be performed by a PA, but they require the use of fluoroscopy. The same is true for other procedures such as joint injections and aspirations. Allowing me to perform these procedures will free the physician to treat more complex patients. This will improve the timeliness of care to all of our patients while still preserving patient safety. As I've worked with our interventional radiologists, I've developed a respect both for the utility of fluoroscopy as well as the dangers associated with ionizing radiation. It is always my goal to provide care as safely as possible, and this is why I support the approach of House Bill 2880, which has a robust educational component. I believe that a trained, appropriately supervised PA will help deliver safe, timely, and effective care to patients in my practice. I urge you to approve this legislation and bring Oregon into line with the 32 other states that already allow PAs to use fluoroscopy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, and Vice Chair Representative Nose, who happens to be my representative.
Oh, right on.
My name is Judah Goldmarkel. I'm a physician assistant. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2880. I've worked at Legacy Health for the past 11 years in the field of vascular surgery and trauma. Initially, we looked into changing the laws regarding the use of fluoroscopy about 3 to 4 years ago. Over the past several years, we've been working with and gaining consensus on how these changes would be implemented and applied. Frankly speaking, the use of fluoroscopy and minimally invasive interventions is the future of medicine and is essential to allow physicians' assistants to continue to thrive in the fields that utilize this technology. I would like to thank the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging for working with us and the Oregon Society of PAs to develop House Bill 2880. The Board of Medical Imaging deliberated thoughtfully on this issue, convened multiple workshops with multiple stakeholders, and ultimately voted to approve a proposal that represents a reasonable compromise to this situation. 32 states, as mentioned before, currently allow PAs to practice fluoroscopy. 20 of those states simply have no requirements or regulations for PAs to practice fluoroscopy. With House Bill 2880, Oregon would join 12 other states that have the most rigorous requirements for PAs to practice fluoroscopy. House Bill 2880 creates a certification process through the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging. The certification process includes three important components. The first is education. In order to obtain a fluoroscopy certificate from the OBMI, a PA must complete at least 80 hours of clinical and didactic training as outlined in the fluoroscopic educational framework for PAs. This framework is a national standard created through the collaboration of the American Association of Physician Assistants and the American Society of Radiation Technologists. The education component includes operation safety, important information about radiation biology, and exposure limits. The second component is an exam. The PA must pass the exam developed by the same national framework. And finally, there's a fee the Board of Medical Imaging will charge to cover the costs of the processing of the certificate application. Once the PA obtains a certificate to practice fluoroscopy, that certificate will go on file as well to the Oregon Medical Board, which licenses PAs. A supervising physician may only delegate fluoroscopy procedures to PAs who have a certificate. When a PA is practicing fluoroscopy, a radiation technologist or a physician must also be in the room, and the PA's supervising physician must be available in the building to assist in case of emergency. I am pleased with House Bill 2880 and the collaborative effort it took to craft this legislation. I urge that all of you please support this bill, and I appreciate the time you've given us. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Yes, quick.
Yes, sir.
Clarification. Currently, a PA is not allowed to do this, or there's no certificate process?
PA is not allowed to do this in Oregon.
So what you're asking to do is to be allowed to do it, but you're saying, but we're going to have this requirement to
exactly.
become educated or competent in that procedure.
Correct. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have one more witness in this. Please call the last witness.
Pat Williams.
Consumer Protection.
This is new for me. Hello, Chair Greenlick and committee members. I am Pat Williams, and I'm a radiology assistant. And I am here because I'm concerned about House Bill 2880. The PAs don't have a certificate that is correct to step on the fluoro button. However, neither do any of the doctors unless they have the certifications. My concern is that they lack the education. A 40-hour course certainly does not cover everything. For me to be a radiology assistant, I first had to have 15 hours to become a radiology technologist, and then another 2 hours and a 2 year or 2,000 hour and 2 year course to be a radiology assistant. I think a 40 hour online course just does not cover the dangers or just the safety for patients that the education that a radiology assistant or a radiographer has. I know that the ASRT, has suggested at least they want some control over this to do the 40-hour and take the test. Now, the American College of Radiology, which is the radiologist, they recommend 40 hours of didactic and 40 hours of clinical experience supervised by a radiologist or a medical physicist. It's just so disconcerting to me that it'd be easy for anybody a 40-hour, well, they have medical background, and PAs are wonderful for where they're needed, but I don't feel that they're needed in radiology, and I don't feel that they have or nor can gain enough education to safely image patients, pediatrics or adults. The FDA and the ACR and the American Society of Radiologic Technologists have programs to image wisely for the pediatrics, image gently for adults. And I just feel that that's not enough time. I would like 40 hours is not enough training. I would like the committee to please think about this. You know, there's over 3,000 radiographers that can step on the pedal for him to fluoro and do his joint injections or whatever. That's all this means is they are allowed to their own self step on the pedal to fluoro. But there's, like I say, in Oregon alone, 3,000 radiographers that can do that for him. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much.
One quick.
Yes, go ahead.
Chair Greenlick. Thank you for your presentation. I just have one quick question on adverse. My understanding from previous testimony is that Oregon would be joining 12 other states. Do we have any, scanning down through this quickly, do we have any data that says that there is an adverse event or a greater chance of an adverse event in those 12 states versus the ones that don't allow for it?
I would say most of it's probably not. Thank you, Vice Chair Hayden. That most of it is not probably recorded. Most of those states do not have any guidelines for the radiologic technologists as far as licensure. Washington State just wants you to have ARRT licensure. They don't have boards like the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging, which is wonderful, and follows, and everything has to be documented. So anything, an incident could occur, and no one's going to know it because it's not documented by any government board or official. That's the other concern is who's going to watch how much floral time they're using. As a RA, mine's all documented. I have to answer to all that, you know. So I'm just guessing. I'm not positive, but I'm sure that from what I've read, most of those states do not even require licensure. So there's nobody to check what they're doing or what's happening.
Oh, just a quick follow up on that. I
think the answer is no.
No. No, the answer is no. Okay. I'm sorry.
But on follow up on the documentation. I would suspect that there is documentation, whether it's under the physician or the efficient assistance. I just can't imagine that there's not documentation for that procedure.
I requested the OBMI, or I questioned them at the time of this, who's going to keep track of all this? And the answer was kind of, well, you know, we really don't know. We're not sure. So there may be, but that's not proven yet either, that there's going to be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you say there are amendments proposed to this?
Yes. Did you? I can give you very briefly. The dash one changes the operative date from what currently is in the bill, August 1, 2016, to January 1, 2016. It also modifies that the supervising physician has to be in the building, not as it's currently written in the bill. I think it says direct. The proximity, they have to be in the same room, whereas if they're in the building, then it covers. The dash two modifies the definition of fluoroscopy to align with the federal definition of fluoroscopy.
I think we'll close the public hearing and we'll come back to this on a different day for a work session. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2880 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2876. Madam Minister, what have we got here?
House Bill 2876 prohibits healthcare facilities from allowing a person without specified qualifications and education to practice surgical technology. It provides an exception for the healthcare facilities in rural or medically underserved areas of the state, directs the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules necessary to carry out the provisions of the bill relating to surgical technology, and it has an emergency clause.
Okay. Would you call up first panel?
Tara Cruz, Don Brenteis, and Mark Hearn. Brentis?
Actually,
it's
Dreese,
D-R-E-E-S-E. Oh, I am so sorry.
She was close.
Wasn't even close. That's why I have her do it. Okay, again, we have about 15 minutes.
All right.
We'll keep brief.
We've been at this for a while.
Yes. So thank you very much. My name is Tara Cruz, and I am here with the Oregon Association of Surgical Technologists and as a surgical tech or scrub tech. And thank you to Representative Greenlick for sponsoring our bill, and Chair Greenlick and the committee for hearing us today. I will run through. I have a presentation, and I tell you the Kentucky Derby of presentations in the interest of our time. So I am here today as a professional from the operating room with my perspective. So this legislative process is new to me, and you have welcomed me into it, and I've appreciated that very much. It's been an amazing process. Now we'll get some pictures here. This is part of what it looks like in the operating room. So who are all these people? We have the surgeon, who is the main professional in the room. We also have the anesthesiologist, without whom there would not be that teamwork to make the surgery happen. We have a circulating nurse who is not scrubbed in, and they are the person that helps to do the charting. They bring the patient into the room in most facilities, and they also go get things as it's necessary. There's a change in the procedure that warrants more supplies. And sometimes there's a first assist or a PA. They're helping out as well. And then there is me, or us. And we are there. What does my day look like? Well, this morning I was in the OR, and after this I'll be back in the OR. So I start preparing for my cases when they're planned the day before or the week before, looking at what equipment we're going to need. Do we have the implants that we need? Making sure that my case is picked correctly. When I get in for the day, I scrub and I open the room, and a lot of times the nurse is going over and checking with the patient, and it's just us in the room. So I went through a program that was 2 years long and had a year of clinicals,
And through that program, I developed a strong surgical conscience. So that means that if something is contaminated, that I say, hey, I realize that this is a cost thing to scrap this whole setup, but it's worth the patient safety. And I gained that confidence through being in a room all by myself where I have my checks and balances for this. We then set up the procedure, and if there's one way to do a single procedure, there are a million ways to do that single procedure. So I'm familiar with what all of the different surgeons like for that setup, and that can be vastly different and make a difference between a smooth case or a rough case. This is an example of a setup. And this is not my setup. I would have lined that line straight over just a little bit more. We're very particular about how we do things, and I can turn my back table and without looking and taking my eye off the patient, where I have one hand retracting in and holding someone's guts to where I'm not killing their bowel but also keeping the muscle back, I can load a sponge stick with the other hand and be handing it over to the surgeon and not have to be taking my focus off the patient. This is an example of just one of the setups for one of the cases that we deal with. And if all of those instruments on the left of the towel look the same, they're actually all vastly different and serve different things. And this is one of the just quick study guides.
I think you need to move on.
Okay, really quickly. Surgeons have pet names for them. It's not just the one thing that they're called. So, yeah, here we are in the OR doing all kinds of different things, helping gown and glove and set up the room. And we help to suction. We help to retract. We help to do keeping the room moving smoothly. We manage specimens. So if we get three different lymph nodes out and one of them has cancer and the other two don't, us marking them properly is a big deal to make sure that those diagnoses and treatments are carried out appropriately. Whose hands are which in that bottom picture, we can't tell because the scrub techs are right in there as well. Robot surgeries. I have recently been in a case where the surgeon is at the console and we're the ones up by the patient and had some really scary things happen that we had eyes on.
We're going to run out of time. You need to speak to the bill.
So the bill, right here we go. We have got, so suffice to say, we work hard during surgery and we're right in there. And the bill has provisions for, we accept military training. We recognize that, a grandfather clause. People have been scrubbing for 30 years, could scrub circles around me. Two of the last 3 years qualifies. We've got the grace period for people taking their test. When they finish school, they have a year to finish their test when they can be working. There is the rural provision where if somebody is having trouble or medically underserved, having trouble finding a certified scrub tech, then they have a year in which to collaborate with an online program. And that looks out for them as well. There are studies showing that there is a reduced case of surgical site infections. And so this is helping to protect them and their patients as well. We have for the bill as well. It helps speed up surgeries. These are all these different states that have current legislative pieces in place, the ones working on it. We have two accredited programs in Oregon in addition to the online programs. They graduate, it's proprietary information, but the schools told me that it's between 70 and 90 between the two of them, that they graduate per year. So that's the next available pool. And according to the schools, they're actually trying to reduce the number of people coming in because the market is flooded currently. I am from a rural area. I understand retention can be a thing, so that rural provision is a big deal to me, where you can hire somebody out to the boonies, but keeping them there is a thing. So having the online program accessible where the people don't have to leave that area is important. We protect patients. We anticipate. We assure patient safety, and this is something that I believe in, not something I'm hired to do or because I needed another hobby. I would like it to not take any of you getting a surgical site infection or a retained foreign body to think, I really wish everyone in the OR had training.
I really think we need to move on.
Perfect.
I mean, you are doing the job now. The bill would require something else, and it would be useful for you to explain why this something else would be important. So perhaps if one of the next two.
Sure.
You have 3 minutes between you.
I can be very brief.
That'd be great.
Chair Greenlee, care committee members, my name is Don Dries. And I've been doing this since 1981. I learned in the military, did a dozen years there, came out and did 10 more in the reserves, and have been in the civilian sector since then. And this is very important. I've worked with technicians who are not certified, have not been to a course, and have had to intervene when bad things could have happened. Retained objects, wrong size surgeries. It's not often, but just one time is bad enough. And this bill will address that. I love what I do. I think it's a hidden occupation. No one knows who we are because we don't talk to the patients before or afterwards. But what we do is integral to the success of the case, especially speaking to surgical site infections. We do things, a dozen things every few minutes that we don't even realize anymore because we've been trained to a certain standard. And those things speak to how well the case goes. And in the interest of keeping it short, that's it. Do you have any questions? I'd be glad to speak to anybody.
My name is Michael Hearn. I've been a surgical tech for 22 years. I spent the last 12 years at Sacred Heart Medical Center in Lane County as a surgical tech. In Oregon, a parent who has a school-aged child would assume that the driver of that school bus has a driver's license. He would assume that that driver also has additional training to understand the laws of bus driving, railroad track crossings, and so on. And he has demonstrated to someone that they can indeed physically handle a school bus. And they would assume this to be second nature. Also in Oregon, a parent may have a child going in for surgery, be it a tonsillectomy, appendicitis, or maybe fixing a broken bone that was, you know, received on a playground. They have the expectation that those persons involved in that surgery are also qualified. They have been educated in the scope of their job, that they have been practiced and observed, and they have passed other people's scrutiny and are able to do their job properly. Alas, here in Oregon, a second scenario is in fact not a given. The surgical tech there may or may not be well trained. He may be very good, he may be marginally good, he may be somebody who was doing something else a month ago. All the patients in Oregon deserve a certified surgical technologist on the surgical team, and you are people who can make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Yes.
Thank you for your presentation. Your slides made me a little homesick there watching it.
But not too homesick.
No. Thanks for bringing this important problem to our attention. As a surgeon, I think the public would be aghast at the level of training of some surgical technologists, or I should say the lack of training. This bill is really desperately needed in the state, and I'm overwhelmingly supportive.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Okay, I think we have a couple of people who want to
thank you.
Speak not so favorably of the bill.
I anticipated that. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Dr. Ballard says hello.
Thanks for your persistence on this one.
12 years.
That's the third session or something?
I think so. My first one, I'm very educational, and I appreciate the process, but it's been a process.
That's how we feel, too.
Indeed.
Patty O'Sullivan and Doug Barber.
Both of you guys, briefly, please. We're out of time, but we'll run a little over, and the next committee will be mad at me.
We'll be very brief. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm here today to oppose House Bill 2876. As was mentioned here, this bill comes up almost every session, and every session it usually goes nowhere. Surgical technicians are very important, and it's very important that they're experienced. Surgeons many times like to grow their own surgical technicians, and in many hospitals out there, they have grown their own, and the relationship between the surgical tech and the surgeon has to be very, very close. They have to know exactly what each other is doing, and many times the surgeon does like to train and sort of have their own person there. The association recently queried other state hospital associations looking for any data to say what is the purpose of certifying surgical technicians. Is there bad things happening? Do the patient safety commission have any data on what's going on? What's the purpose for this bill? And we were unable to find any. I do hear Representative Bueller say that, you know, people might be appalled, but I don't have any data and cannot find any data to show that.
If a physician wanted to grow their own scrub nurse, you would you wouldn't have any problem with that? I mean, you wouldn't bother with nursing school. I mean,
Chair Greenlick, of course we would. This is something that typically is not certified, has never been certified, and we just oppose certifying them. Our rural hospitals can't find surgical technicians as it is, and for them to have to go and go to school for 2 years and then come back, there's no guarantee they'll come back to those rural areas. We have a hard time filling those types of positions. In the Portland metro area, many of the hospitals already require education and or certification, but it's not mandatory, it's preferred.
Thank you. Doug?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of Peace Health in opposition to House Bill 2976 or 2876. The certification is one of the criteria that should be used in the hiring process, along with education and training and experience, but we don't believe certification should be elevated to being a necessary condition of employment. At Peace Health, we have 38 surgical techs. 14 of them are certified. We also have one of the highest ranked surgery programs in the United States, the American College of Surgeons National Surgical Quality Improvement Program ranks it in the top 10 in the country. If there was a problem with our surgical techs being unqualified, incompetent, we would be hearing about it on a regular basis from our surgeons, and we are not hearing any complaints from our surgeons about the standards and quality of our surgical techs. So we just think that there isn't a problem here that this bill is trying to solve. Thank you.
You're confident there isn't a problem anywhere in the state? Are you testifying there's not a problem anywhere? There's not a problem at Peace?
We don't see a problem at Peace Health, and we have 24 surgical techs who do not have this certification.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Do we have time for one more?
Oh, do we have another witness?
Well, she was in that mix, but I knew you were running out of time.
Let's bring her up.
Catherine Sparkman.
Please introduce yourself. And be brief.
Thank you. Chairman Greenlink, member of the committee, my name is Catherine Sparkman. I am the Director of Government and Public Affairs for the Association of Surgical Technologists, the National Association of approximately 40,000 surgical technologists. We are headquartered in Denver, Colorado, which I might mention is less sunny than Oregon this time of year. So,
weather's terrible.
Thank you for the sunshine. So, I'm not sure I can add for what you have heard from the professional practitioners. Our Oregon advocates are passionate and informed, and they are the experts. But just a little bit about myself and why this is important to me. I am a recovering lawyer. I practiced medical malpractice defense for facilities for about three decades before representing a variety of healthcare professional organizations, including operating room nurses and surgical technologists. A number of years ago, the Oregon legislature was one of the first to adopt a surgical patient safety bill sponsored by Senator Allen Bates, requiring competency of registered nurses who served in the operating room. This is an addition and an extension of the debt and the obligations that we owe to our patients in the operating room. I am all too familiar, being a medical malpractice attorney, about the importance of competent and trained and skilled personnel in treating patients in their most vulnerable condition. They are asleep on the operating room table. I dare say patients in Oregon may not and most likely do not know the competency of the members of their surgical team. I also know a little bit about the increase in surgical procedures. In 2010, there were 16 million. In 2016, it's estimated to be close to 20 million. And the number of surgical site infections that are derived from those surgical procedures. The National Institute of Health estimates 99,000 deaths each year from surgical site infections, a healthcare cost of $45 billion. Hospital readmissions from surgical site infections is also profound. A recent study by the Journal of the American Medical Association just this month said that surgical site infections are 19.4% of all readmissions. We are all obviously committed to mitigating those. The data, which I'm sorry the Hospital Association did not accumulate, it is hard to do. I respect that. But we have done two studies, one in Virginia, which shows that hospitals who are required to hire certified surgical technologists and educated certified technologists experience an 11% reduction in the costs of readmissions. In Minnesota, which must publish its adverse events each year, hospitals which have a policy of hiring only certified surgical technologists experience a 40% reduction in the 6 adverse preventable surgical errors. It is more than common sense.
Would you send us
I'm sorry?
Would you send us those studies?
Yes, and it's also in the sources
in the
are
data,
in,
so
in the
we
PowerPoint
already have
as well. I came to AST in 2008, and at that time
we're going to have to end this.
Yes. I just wanted to mention, because I know the Hospital Association had, there are 10 states now since 2009 that have adopted this requirement: Texas, New York, Indiana, New Jersey, Colorado, South Carolina, Illinois, Virginia, and Tennessee join Washington State. Massachusetts was one of the last. That bill was promoted and sponsored by the energies of the University of Massachusetts Medical Center, the hospitals there. I would hope that Oregon would join those states who have recently recognized the importance of having a competent surgical team. And I urge your support of House Bill 2876.
Thank you so much. I close the public hearing on House Bill 2876. And we'll be back to talk about this bill on another day. We are adjourned.
Adjourned.
We are adjourned. On another day.